Court of Appeal, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable J. Robert Leach presiding.
Please be seated. Morning, Council. Welcome to the last day of our July session. Our first case is State v. Reed. After counsel for appellant has argued, we'll have the podium wiped down before you can argue, counsel, and we'll do the same thing before you do your rebuttal. That's one of our precautions. If during argument your mask falls down off your nose, please put it back on top of your nose. We kind of defeat the purpose of the masks if your nose isn't covered. And with that, are you ready to proceed?
Good morning. May it please the court. Chris Gibson on behalf of Mr. John Reed. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
We're asking this court to reverse and remand for a new trial based on three errors that occurred in this case. One of them involves exclusion of evidence, defense evidence. The other involves admission of improper opinion testimony. And the third involves prosecutorial misconduct. I'd like to focus on the prosecutorial misconduct issue with this court's
ruling. Can I ask you a couple of questions about one of your other issues first?
Certainly.
You argue in your brief that Mr. Reed was deprived of his right to present a defense when the trial court struck a question and answer submitted to David Dick. My question for you is there any reason the defense couldn't have called Mr. Dick in its case and presented the evidence that was stricken?
I can't come up with a good answer that would support my case on that.
Then how's he deprived of a right to present a defense? Because the issue is whether or not he got to present information to the jury, not whether it came in the state's case or his own case.
Right, and it was raised in the context of the cross-examination of Mr. Dix by Mr. Reed's attorney, and he was trying to elicit that information and wasn't allowed to.
I understand that, and if he was wrong, it might be an abuse of discretion, but you have couched this as a constitutional issue, and I'm just curious as to how he didn't get to present the evidence if he could have called Mr. Dick as his own witness.
Right. My best answer is all I can do is rely upon the brief. And I understand
all right.
That is not...
Go ahead to your misconduct argument.
Thank you very much. The state has conceded that what the prosecutor did in this case constituted misconduct. During cross-examination of Mr. Reed's response that former Texas law enforcement officer Bruce Cheeks had been dismissed from his job for lying under oath, prosecutor said, that's not true. There was no objection, but it was clearly misconduct. Prosecutors, defense attorneys, attorneys representing their clients are not allowed to testify at the trials. They have to get testimony from witnesses, present exhibits, but they can't testify on their own.
Would you characterize this misconduct as flagrant?
Yes, I would.
And do you have a case that you would rely on?
Well, not specifically for this type of conduct, but I think it's well settled that the rule that you cannot testify as an attorney representing somebody in a trial is well established.
I would agree with that, but the state makes an argument about this being an immediate response that wasn't thought about, which, you know, there's a mental element to flagrant conduct normally. And people who've tried cases know that in the heat of the moment, sometimes you say something you'd like to pull back as soon as the words are leaving your mouth.
Right. I recognize that the state has characterized it as an unguarded response. Well, that's not sufficient for a prosecutor who's held to a higher standard when it comes to ensuring defense.
I think we all agree it was misconduct.
Okay.
But when you don't make an objection at trial, the standard on a review is higher.
It is. I have to prove that it was flagrant, ill-intentioned misconduct, which an instruction could not have cured and was prejudicial to the defendant.
Why wouldn't an instruction have cured it?
Because, again, prosecutors are held in high regard in the community in general and recognized as being credible individuals for jurors. I think that's recognized that there's a special place, and when prosecutors make comments that they shouldn't and expose juries to those comments, it's not an instruction to ignore that, particularly in this case, which was so key to the defense, which was my client's credibility, by making a statement that that's not true, tells the jury that my client is lying on the stand when credibility is the key to his defense, and that Bruce Cheeks was not lying on the stand when he talked about how he said Mr. Reed said, I can bury bodies up on the bench. So This...
Well, they actually found the buried bodies up on the bench, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean, they did, but the issue was, did he tell Mr. Cheeks that in advance of what was going on here? I think this was...
I mean, it strikes me, Mr. Reed concedes that he shot these people.
Yes.
He concedes that he buried the bodies. He concedes that he tried to hide their vehicles over the edge of the ravine. I'm having a little trouble understanding how this is that critical to the case when the real issue is whether or not he was shooting in self-defense because of the conduct of the two victims.
Right. And because, I mean, Mr. Reed gave an explanation of what occurred. He says, I killed these people, but I did it in self-defense. And he gave a reasonable explanation and description of what occurred. And that his description was corroborated, at least in part, by the medical examiner's testimony that, yes, these shots, these wounds could have been inflicted in the manner in which Mr. Reed said that this occurred.
Well, you know, one might quibble with the word corroborated. Not excluded by the medical testimony might be a better characterization.
That might be one way to put it. I look at it as somewhat corroboration because he's saying, yes, this could have occurred how he had described it. So that aside, once the prosecutor made the comment that Mr. Reed is lying, and I know that Mr. Cheeks was right and Mr. Reed is lying, that sent a message to this jury that this defendant is lying to you. Don't believe him. And as I said before, you can't, an instruction to ignore that could not easily have been compartmentalized and ignored by the jurors once it came out, particularly because it came out through the prosecutor. The credibility was his only defense. Once the prosecutor said he's lying, that defense was bound to be rejected. And I think the fact that the jury in this case deliberated, this is a month-long trial, deliberated for about 4.5 hours. That's in the record in the sentencing. So it was a very short deliberation given the quantity and complexity of all the evidence that was submitted. And I think that we can look at this and say this, it's likely that that comment that the defendant is lying to the jury could reasonably have a significant impact on the jury's deliberations and the rejection of his self-defense claim.
Objection, counsel. The prosecutor wasn't present. Prosecutor has no firsthand knowledge. The prosecutor is not allowed to testify. Court goes. Sustained, the jury will disregard. Seems to me that taints the prosecutor more heavily than the comment itself tainted the witness.
Well, I guess I'll respectfully disagree. I think that once that comment was made, an objection wouldn't have done any good because telling the jury to ignore that comment when the prosecutor, this highly regarded member of the judiciary, makes a comment that guy's lying and I know Cheeks was not. Mr. Cheeks was not dismissed from his job.
You know, some might question how highly regarded the Snohomish County Prosecutor's Office is in the community. It's had its fair share of bad press.
It has. But in general, I think that they are highly regarded.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Counsel?
I even made a note, wait for cleanup, and then didn't do it.
See, it's autopilot. You've been here too many times.
Yeah, this term has been revealing as to how eager attorneys are to get to the podium and how severe time pressure seemed to be felt. Everybody's very anxious.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Seth Fine, Deputy Prosecutor for Snohomish County, representing the respondent, the state of Washington. Let me start by saying, with regard to the prosecutorial misconduct issue, I think this case is a good illustration of why prosecutorial misconduct is a misleading label, because blurting out a remark like that what was made here in response to some surprising unsolicited, inadmissible evidence is a grave mistake. It is something the prosecutor should not have done, but it's quite a stretch to call it misconduct, and really prosecutorial error is a much better label for this kind of mistake.
Aren't we stuck with that label? Our state Supreme Court has been asked to adopt the label that you're advocating and has asserted that because of precedent and the ability to find cases on point, we need to stick with the label we've been using.
Yeah.
Aren't we kind of hamstrung with that?
I would say no, and certainly this court must apply the law that the Supreme Court has handed down. But as for terminology, I think you have more flexibility in what words to use in your opinion. And I recall you to the old label of a meretricious relationship. It was this court, not the Supreme Court, that initially abandoned that label, even though it had been firmly established in the law and consistently used for a period of some 50 years. And then the Supreme Court said, yes, Court of Appeals, you are right. We're going to give up that label, too.
We don't have someone from the prosecutorial side of the world who has the same prominence that Judge Kennedy had in the family law world, though.
Maybe not. And I don't want to waste too much time or spend too much time on this. The terminology is important, but it ultimately does not bear on the result of the case. The test is what it is, no matter what you call it.
So this was certainly a mistake, and it was a mistake that in which the prosecutor commented directly on credibility. So isn't that more difficult to ask a jury to set aside than other types of error?
Potentially, yes. And it is a mistake of the kind that has in the past been labeled as misconduct. The test is whether the defendant can demonstrate a substantial likelihood that the misconduct affected the jury's verdict, and that's taking into account any curative instruction that the court could have given. So in looking at this, I think there's three key points that the court ought to consider. The first is that this is a very short incidental remark. We have four words spoken in the course of a 13-day trial, never alluded to again. And I don't believe that any of the prior cases that have reversed a conviction based on misconduct have dealt with such an incidental event. But there's also two other very unusual features of this. First is that it's a matter not only outside the personal knowledge of the prosecutor, which is common, but outside the personal knowledge of the defendant. The defendant was not a co-worker of Mr. Dick and had no way of knowing why it was that Mr. Dick left or lost his job.
Cheeks.
Pardon?
It's Cheeks, isn't it?
Cheeks, I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Cheeks, I'm sorry. Different witness, Mr. Dick. Okay. The argument is that the prosecutor accused him of lying, but a statement can be not correct, even though it is not a lie, if you have no personal knowledge on the subject. That also makes potentially a curative instruction much more easily accepted. If the court tells them prosecutor has no knowledge, the witness has no knowledge, they can't bring in things they've heard from other people, so disregard all of this. You know, the third thing, and this is extremely unusual, is that the defendant, in a legal sense, the defendant won this encounter. He used the prosecutor's remark as an opportunity to put in some evidence along the same line, and he got in before the jury some facts that otherwise could not have been admitted and that were helpful to his case. His claim that Mr. Cheeks had told him that he lost his job for lying. That became evidence since the jury heard it from a witness and there was no contradiction of it. Whereas the prosecutor's remark, as the jury was told, was not evidence. If we assume that jurors followed their instructions, the outcome was the defendant was better off having put in evidence that was favorable to him.
Is he really in the same place as he would have been if he had made his remark and it hadn't gone commented on? Because you'd have had the same quality of evidence, a statement from Mr. Reed that Mr. Cheeks lost his job for lying.
Well, no. I mean, let's assume that the defendant had not volunteered and the interchange had been just Mr. Cheeks lost his job for lying. That's not true. And we've got a flat-out contradiction there, although still one in which the defendant could have had apparently no source of knowledge as well, and could have said something that was not true because he wasn't there and didn't know. But then the defendant comes back with, well, that's what he told me. Now, look what's before the jury at this point. Basically, what we have is the prosecutor doesn't know. The prosecutor is ignorant. Defendant knows more about this than the prosecutor. Because the prosecutor, of course, was not privy to the conversation between Mr. Cheeks and the defendant. So the prosecutor thinks it isn't true, but what he doesn't know is that the defendant knows this because he was told by Mr. Cheeks himself. And that's where the subject is dropped. The prosecutor doesn't say, no, that isn't true. He never told you that. He just leaves it with the defendant's claim, I've got information on this. I actually know more about this than you do. And they move on. So the effect of this incident is at least decidedly mixed and contains connotations that are quite favorable to the defendant, showing his superior knowledge on this particular topic. And
we haven't been shown it probably changed the result.
That's right. There is, the bottom line is, when you take everything about this incident, the favorable and the unfavorable portion, there is no substantial likelihood that it affected the jury's verdict. And moreover, there is no showing that a court's instruction to the jury on this point, an instruction that neither person knew what they were talking about, so it ought to be disregarded, there's no reason to believe that such an instruction would have been ineffective. So this remark, although unfortunate, was not enough to affect the jury's verdict. You see in the appellant's brief the shibboleth that trained and experienced prosecutors don't take chances unless they're convinced it's necessary. And I sort of think this incident shows that they may be trained, they may be experienced, they unfortunately, you might wish that they always think about every remark before they say it, but unfortunately, like other lawyers, sometimes they act unthinkingly. It's unfortunate, but it's up for this court to determine whether there's a substantial likelihood that it affected the verdict. In this case, it did not. The conviction should be affirmed.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to clarify the record in this case. What Mr. Reed testified to was my son told me that Mr. Cheeks lost his job due to lying under oath. So there was some source of knowledge for Mr. Reed's comment. That's rather irrelevant. But for the state to argue that the prosecutor did not have knowledge, when the prosecutor clearly stated that's not true, implying that prosecutor did have knowledge that Mr. Cheeks didn't lose his job from lying under oath. So I don't think the trial court could have said, if there had been an objection, nobody knows what they're talking about here, ignore that comment, because the prosecutor clearly indicated he had information that Mr. Reed was lying about Mr. Cheeks. Secondly, the state brought up the fact that this occurred, this was just a brief moment in trial. Well, it was at the very end of trial when Mr. Reed was testifying, the last witness. And they said it was never referred to again. That's not true either. It was referred to in closing arguments by the prosecutor when they alluded to the fact that if Mr. Reed had evidence that Mr. Cheeks lost his job under oath, you can bet there would have been evidence presented. So that's a reference back to that.
Why haven't you made an issue of that?
What's that?
Why haven't you made an issue of that statement? You could argue that the prosecutors are requiring the defendant to present some evidence. I was surprised that wasn't an issue.
Well, I may have made a mistake not raising that as well. But it still goes to the point that the prosecutor did use this exchange as part of his closing remarks, which is further evidence that he thought it might be a close case because of Mr. Reed's relatively credible explanation of what actually occurred. So I don't think it's fair to say that this was just a passing reference and no big deal, nor do I think that's a trial court telling the jury to ignore it because neither Mr. Reed nor the prosecutor knows what they're talking about and doesn't fit with the record we have in this case. We have the prosecutor stating, I know that that's not true, so I therefore know it's easy extension that Mr. Reed is lying to you. And if he's lying to you about that, he's probably lying to you about everything else.
What if there had been an instruction that the prosecutor has no personal knowledge of the reasons for Mr. Cheek's termination, and you are to ignore anything that he has said on this point.
Maybe, I don't know. I don't know how that would have worked out. But I still think
well,
you've got
to... Don't we have to be persuaded that wouldn't have cured the error before we can accept your position?
I think I go back to the fact that prosecutors are highly regarded in the community, and they are...
Don't we ask jurors to disregard much more impactful types of things that come out in trial? I mean, 404B evidence that's only limited for that's only admitted for a limited purpose. Ignore that this person raped two kids before this.
Right.
You can't use it for this reason.
Yes, and I think that that is much more easily for that type of thing is much easier for a juror to compartmentalize and say, okay, I can't consider this. But I think the fact that you've got the prosecuting agency coming up and saying, I know that this guy is lying, is such a powerful statement and cannot be compartmentalized like something like hearsay or 404B evidence. It's coming from a highly respected person of the judiciary, and
well,
jurors have faith in him.
Hold on. He's not in the judiciary. He's a member of the executive branch.
He's a member of the executive branch and the
He's
prosecutor.
He's got nothing to do with us.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Let's be clear.
It's very clear in my mind now, so I will quit using judiciary. But because of who said it and when they said it, and the reference to it in closing argument, I don't. Instruction wouldn't have cured the prejudice, and he's entitled to a new trial that's fair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Court will be in recess.
Recorded in recess.